You're just in time for our conversation with our profile guest this morning. We're speaking, joined by activist, filmmaker, and the founder of Ditsi Media. Dr. Beverly Ditsi joins us this morning as our profile guest, and I'm thrilled that we're able to have her, especially in such an important week as internationally we mark International Lesbian Week of Visibility. Yesterday, we were marking 30 years of the birth of South Africa's democracy, and she has been crucial in working in both those areas. And so I'm very happy that we have her on the show. If you'd like to speak to Dr. Ditsi, you can call us on 011-883-0702, SMS us on 31702, or send us your WhatsApp messages on 0727021702. Dr. Ditsi, it is a great pleasure to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Googs. Good morning, listeners. Good morning, everybody. I'm so thrilled to be here with you. I'm really, really honored for the invitation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. And I think for me, it's just so great that we're able to have you, A, in the week where the country celebrates quite an important and auspicious occasion, but also in such an important week, International Lesbian Week of Visibility, which, you know, for me, it feels as if it is the merging of two areas that you have done so much work throughout your life in. And I wonder if it does feel that way, that it is this meeting of two crucial parts of your work.
Oh, yes, my life converging almost literally to a very large degree. So I think yesterday I was thinking to myself, wow, not only did I not think that I would be here to see the 30 years, but also to be very out and proud and be able to post on my social media, hey, happy Lesbian Visibility Week, and hope everybody's safe, you know, because, you know, we're living in a world now that is going more conservative by the day. And to be able to even have the freedom to be able to say that and be out and be public and be loud is quite a thing. I think it needs to be acknowledged no matter what our issues are. I am in awe sometimes of how far we have come with, I mean, we've got lots of issues and I'm sure we will get into them. But yes, I do feel like a lot of my life's work converged in this past week leading up to today.
Yeah. And, you know, for yesterday, one of the questions I asked of our listeners is, do you remember where you were on the 27th of April, 1994? Do you remember where you were? Do you have memories of that day?
In a queue. Of course, in a queue. Yeah. I could vote. I was in a queue. It was the longest queue I've ever sat in. I've sat in longer queues now in the hospital, at Home Affairs. You know what I mean? But that queue, I remember standing there with my best friend, and my gran and my mom had gone earlier. These are people who wake up at 5 in the morning. So they'd already kind of, as the sun was rising, they already done their thing. I was there with my bestie in the afternoon, and it was mostly young people. And I just kept getting these chills, these goosebumps. I think the first time I felt that level of excitement and thrill was at the first Gay Pride March, Gay and Lesbian Pride March in Johannesburg in 1990, where it was just an overwhelming feeling of, oh my goodness, we are doing this. Mm. It's a first. And it had such significance, you know? Yeah. And so we stood in that queue, we were bantering, we were laughing. It was so much fun standing in that queue. And then of course, going into the booth and making that mark, there was some tears. Yeah. I don't think that, you know, anyone who did that day did not have tears. Yeah. I cried a little bit because, wow, the significance is something that I don't think can be measured.
Mm. And I wonder for you what it felt like when we then adopted the new constitution. One of my favorite parts of the constitution is the Equality Act.
Yes.
I mean, I love the whole constitution. I don't know if you can love a constitution, but I really love the constitution. And my favorite part is Section 9, which is the Equality Act, because, you know, we try to go as far as possible about, you may not discriminate against someone directly and indirectly on the basis of gender, sexual identity, pregnancy, religion, etc. And I wonder, for you, having been a young person that took a really big risk in 1990 to host the first first Pride March on the continent, not just in South Africa, to then mm-hmm. 6 years later, mm-hmm. we adopt this document that says, mm-hmm. you, at least legally, because of course there's always social, cultural, mm-hmm. You know, change that needs to be made. But legally, we have recognized you may not discriminate against someone on the basis mm-hmm. of sexual orientation. What was that like for you, having, you know, 94 was very emotional for you. We then adopted mm. this constitution. And, you know, when we did it, you know, what was that, you know, experience?
I think the one thing that I do not take for granted is how I feel like my life has been charmed to a very large degree. And I'm a glass half full kind of person. Because you might think that I'm saying things are rosy. They're not. But I do actually see the milestones and the positives in most things. My goodness, to come from being born during apartheid to feeling viscerally the discrimination of apartheid, to then going through being discriminated against as a very young, very butch, very mask-presenting lesbian at ages 14, 15, 16, to then being part of the very first Pride March, to then going through the transition into democracy. And then, look, there was a lot of hard work that went into that constitution. There was a lot of campaigning. Mm-hmm. And of course, people who were doing litigation must be acknowledged. The National Coalition for Gay and Lesbian Equality, led by Zaki Ahmad, must be acknowledged for the litigation that they did to actually get the wording and the paperwork. But a lot of the campaigning on the ground was what we were doing, putting our lives on the line to make sure that people understand what this clause means, and then to see it pass.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. You know, I am very proud to feel like I'm one of those people who have lived to see, you know, and taste and fight for, and then live to see and taste freedom in the kind of visceral way. I mean, we are talking about my life here. There are countries where people are being murdered and arrested for their existence, for existing the way that I do. And yet here I am, having contributed with, amongst many others, but having been there and contributed to making sure that this country and where I live is at least safe for us. Is quite incredible.
Yeah,
I cannot take that for granted.
You mentioned right at the beginning of our conversation that, you know, for you, this week is quite it's quite a big week in that it is, you know, 30 years of democracy. It is International Lesbian Week of Visibility, and you were saying you were able to say, "Hey, I'm here." And I saw one of your tweets responding to someone who was saying many young queer people say they don't know their elders. They don't see their elders. They don't see people like them mm-hmm. grow old and, you know, have full mm-hmm. lives. And, you know, it would be nice for other women to share their pictures. And you were replying to that tweet. Yes. And I remember a couple of years ago, I interviewed you for a different platform where you were talking about when you were young, mm-hmm. you spent a lot of time hiding. You spent a lot of your time having to pretend that you weren't who you are. So you couldn't be visible because it was just not socially acceptable, culturally acceptable. I mean, the apartheid regime was also, while it was white supremacist, it was patriarchal. And it was cis heteronormative. So for you, you know, growing up, what was that experience of having to, I guess, hide yourself where you couldn't be visible, even though you were very different? You go on to talk about like how your eyes were different. You were smarter in school. You read a lot faster than everyone, but you had to pretend that you weren't reading as fast as everyone. So all of the ways that you had to pretend you weren't who you were.
We mask a lot. Hey, we tone ourselves down and we survive. I think that's what that is. I was very, very happy when I saw, her name is Professor Uju Anya, and she's with her partner, Siri. She's Nigerian, her partner is Ghanaian, and she's the one that posted that thing about young people not seeing older lesbians. And you know, Cooks, it's such an awesome question, because when I was growing up, there was nobody like me. that I knew of. There were no words that I knew of. It was a very lonely existence. I think every time I say I did not think that I would be 52, I did not know what that would look like. I didn't know what kind of life I'd be living, where I'd be living. It's a very, very interesting thing to be a young person and to not see a reflection of yourself, to see an example of how your life can be lived. It is actually quite tragic if you think about it, because everyone has a reflection of themselves. We are demonized to such a degree that even our erasure in media means that anybody else who is anything like me does not see themselves. And what that means is that you grow up, you're fighting for your existence every single day, but you're fighting in the dark too, because there's no example of, you know, what positive, affirming life can be. Mm. And, you know, I did not have a me when I was growing up. And to be able to post something and to have young people going, oh, wait, there's 52-year-olds, there's 70-year-olds. It was actually quite a beautiful thread. I shared a few tears in that thread for exactly that reason.
Yeah.
I don't think I was ever in the closet, Gooks. I didn't have the words to express my difference. I didn't know what that was. And when I found those words and used them, gay being the words and lesbian being the words, when I eventually found those words, I was very excited. So I used them until I realized that the use of the words themselves might also be dangerous for me. So it was quite a rough place to be, because I was excited to find my identity finally after years and years of turmoil. But being able to use them meant that I was endangering my life, you know. And growing up different, those of us who grow up either looking different, either, you know, whether you're talking about disabled people, you're talking, and, you know, right now we're dealing with a lot of autistic siblings, or on the spectrum at least, people are masking, trying to kind of fit into some normativity that has been prescribed for us. And we are hurting ourselves more and more and realizing many of us are kind of going, no.
Yeah.
Your uniqueness is your you-ness.
Mm.
You know, we don't all have to be the same, for goodness sake.
And so,
yeah.
You realize, for instance, that I guess like the power and the freedom of, you know, being, naming yourself in truthfully, right? Because I think many of us can name ourselves in ways that are convenient, that are safe, and many of us are socialized that way. So you figure out that I call myself what I am, but there are potential consequences. And it also then seems to inform this politics for you in this fledgling LGBTQ movement in the country that says, if we're going to make demands for freedom, for dignity, for equality, all of these things that ended up being founding principles, we have to do it for people like me. We have to talk about Black lesbian women, Black queer women in the townships, which already was adding a layer of, because I think, you know, LGBTQ South Africans demanding that be core to the struggle was already people going, oh, but we have so many other demands. And then you saying, but even in this demand that we are making, we have to be specific. Because I guess, was that because of you recognizing that, the freedom would be incomplete, it would be partial, if we didn't name, for instance, poor Black lesbian women?
And the gender non-conforming and the non-binary. You know, listen, I think a couple of things just kind of sprung to mind, Gooks. It's that, remember when we were, you know, in all these different political spaces, even in just high school, when you have a meeting and you have an agenda and they have women's issues at the bottom of the agenda at number 12. And then they would discuss everything else. And then when it comes to that issue, it's like everybody's tired. It's the end of the day. And they're like, and then we just gloss over it and we move on. Mm-hmm. It was very similar to that, where, you know, the minute you start adding and you're saying, wait, if we're talking freedom for all means all, you know, And no, we are not going to the bottom of the agenda. I've experienced this bottom of the agenda in many rooms. At the United Nations, I experienced the bottom of the agenda, where sexual orientation once again was placed right at the bottom at 2, 3 a.m. as delegates with their suitcases are leaving to go to the airport. And they're trying to now finally discuss this issue because it was placed at the bottom of the agenda. Mm. I think it was very clever for a lot of the activists, and most of them were my elders. You know, Simon Nkodi was my elder. Donnie Randall, there's like a few Graham Reeds. There were elders who had foresight, who were very insightful in how they made sure that we bring all issues to the table at the same time and leave no one behind. You know, listen, the freedom movement of the time really meant it with this inclusivity. There was something so beautiful about seeing the kind of equality that we were aspiring to, because we were at the time living it to a very tiny little degree. And I'm talking about now, you know, the periods between 92. I mean, yes, CODESA was a mess, but that was also a time where people were finding their feet, where we were all trying to find each other somehow, right? Within our own movements, it was very similar in that, you know, I was, for the first time in my life, I was sitting in same spaces, sharing the same table, having an equal voice to a white lesbian, a white gay man, or white trans person. I'd never in my life until then seen myself as an equal, because I was told that I'm not. And I was living under a system that made sure that I do not see myself as an equal in those spaces. Mm. And we were aspiring, really, it was phenomenal to be in a space where we were being real. We were being real. I mean, we know what happened, you know, soon after. But in that time, it was actually quite phenomenal how we made sure that we were part of the agenda of the freedom of this country.
Yeah. And I often think of something Dr. Tlaleng Mofokeng says. Of course, she's the UN Special Rapporteur for Right to Health.
Yes.
Where,
yes,
speaking about sexual and reproductive rights, she says a right is a thing you constantly fight for.
Yes.
That even in a country like South Africa, where, you know, the Choice of Termination Act has been in place for almost 20 years now, since 96, mm-hmm, that it is a thing we must fight for. And would you agree that, you know, even once you've achieved a right, even once it, you know, your concerns are on the agenda, that it is this constant fight, the work of keeping a right, extending a right, is never done?
I think the minute you stop raising awareness, the minute you stop educating, look at where we are now, where rights are being reversed because they've been taken for granted. Mm. I'm sorry, I look at the USA as a very big example of pure fascism.
Mm.
But pure. I mean, Roe versus Wade, I think, shook the world. Because here we were looking up at this beacon of democracy and freedom, and all of a sudden women are running around crossing borders in order to have the freedom with their own bodies. It is quite phenomenal. In South Africa, I would venture to say we went from freedom and the euphoria, 1996, 97, 98. And I do remember many of us kind of going, okay, now that we found freedom, we're moving on with our lives. Personally speaking, remember, I was 17 years old when I joined a beginning of a movement. A lot of my activism was in my formative years, which meant that I didn't go to university and I didn't look at my personal career. My career was activism to a degree where I even asked people, what do you think I do for a living? I don't lesbian for a living,
hmm,
right? We don't, I mean, I know there are one or two people that are gay for pay, but unlike, and, you know, contrary to the lies and propaganda, and may I use the word bull, as that's happening in both Uganda and Ghana and all these other places where people are being apparently recruited and paid to be queer.
Mm-hmm.
none of us are paid to be who we are. We just are who we are. And so I did not get to further my career. And I remember, I also grew up as a performer. I'm an artist. I'm a child actor. I've always been a musician. And I found myself in this activist space, and I went with it for over 10 years. And by 96, the question was, okay, phew, we did that. Now let's live.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, what that meant for many of us, and I'm not just talking about queer people either, Googs, I think, you know, many of us will remember the word struggle fatigue.
Yeah.
Where people were like, okay, we're done. We've got the freedom now. Let's now refocus, do other things. And we did that. What that did, unfortunately, was that it left a big vacuum. And where there's a vacuum, something always fills it. The vacuum was political, it was social, it was cultural. There was a vacuum. I mean, I don't remember any existing LGBTI organization, I think, from what, 97, I think, was when there was a big, like, I think the term lesbian, well, I mean, I hate this word, corrective rape, because what are you correcting? I think that's when the spate of killings of lesbians kind of started and grew and grew. Sizagela Sigasa, 07, 07, 07. I will never forget that day. I knew Sizagela well, and how she was brutally, she and her girlfriend Salome, how they were brutally murdered in Meadowlands, in Soweto. You know, there were no organizations. Like, literally, when somebody, if somebody said, what was the organization at the time? After that, yes, movements kind of reemerged just a little bit and started growing. Few Forum for the Empowerment of Women kind of grew from there, with a campaign Rose Has Thorns. But, you know, we all kind of relaxed because we found freedom. I didn't know and didn't realize how much we would still have to fight to keep the freedom that we think we have until then. You know, and I think that's a lesson. Every time I do any talks around the world, that's the lesson, is that you find the freedom and then you take it for granted because you think it's always going to be there. It won't. You're constantly needing to work at it, constantly.
If you've just joined us, we are joined by Dr. Beverly Dietze. She is our profile guest for today, and we're thrilled to have her on the show. If you'd like to speak to her, we are taking your calls on 011-883-0702, your SMSs on 31702, and your WhatsApp messages on 0727021702. Dr. Dietze, before we went to sport, you were speaking about, you know, you being, having other interests, that, you know, you being an activist wasn't the only thing you did. And very many people, I think very few people, because we know you as an activist, someone who was crucial in the LGBTQ plus movement in the country, in the foundation of our democracy, that you were a filmmaker, that you were acting from when you were very young. In fact, your mom was also in the entertainment business. Tell us about that.
I was a child actor. My mom was a musician in the 70s. And that's the next film that I'm working on, Googs. Just a quick plug there. Idlet, film is coming up later in the year. You'll see more of it, or more about it as time goes. But my mom being a big superstar in the 70s meant that I spent a lot of time around actors and musicians and visual artists and painters and dancers. And so I, in my mind as a child, I was always going to be in the entertainment industry. And so when I started acting at the age of 9 and, you know, joining choirs and groups and being a musician at that young age, because, I mean, I traveled, my mom, my sister was much younger, and we were all just like in the music world, in the acting world, and that's where I thought I would be. You know, in my mind, I was never anything else but an entertainer and a performer, which is very interesting. How then, kind of life went a little bit, you know, short left. But moving from being, and I mean, the activism really consumed me because, yes, it was about my life. It was really a life and death situation, particularly when I came out and I was being, you know, harassed and accosted and people coming at me and all kinds of threats and my family standing up for me, which is a blessing in ways that I will never be able to express. My mom is listening. Mama, thank you. I love you. My sis is listening. Mm. Thank you. Yo. these people are my rock, you know. I'm very blessed to have been surrounded by so much love and so much support and affirmation.
Yeah.
And so much so that, you know, it was when I eventually kind of went, wait, what's my life? What's my career? Mm-hmm. It wasn't very difficult to know what to fall back onto.
Yeah.
I fell straight back into TV and film. And it was not an easy transition, but it was because it's been my world since I was a child up until my teens. So going behind the scenes and being in reality television and learning reality TV all the way from the 90s, you know, mid 90s, I was in behind the scenes in reality television, well, in front and in behind, and learning the ropes and being a director and continuing in music and making music videos. It's just been my world.
Yeah.
In fact, I am that before I am the activist. I'm just a...
So the activism, I guess, was it then becomes part of what you do. But in your mind, you were going to be on TV, film, music. Is that where you were seeing yourself when you started?
That was always my line. I think I feel like serendipity had me becoming a true artist. Mm-hmm. Because I do believe that an artist, as Nina Simone said, an artist's job is to reflect the times.
Yeah.
But also not just to reflect the times, because we need to also be aware of how we influence the times. And so my activism became quite a big awareness of what we put out in our media, what we put out in these spaces and how it influences everyone, you know?
Yeah.
And I will give you an example. One of my very first music video that I directed was Chiskop's Funabantuan. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the track, Cooks. It was just around the time of Jack Roll, mm-hmm. when girls were being abducted and girls and women were being abducted en masse all over. I think it was mainly in Soweto, but it was in other areas. And they come up with a song, and you know Mandoza's voice is gruff. Says Funabantuana. For those who don't know, that means we're searching for girls.
Yeah.
We're looking for girls. And they, you know, and I mean, the camaraderie was amazing. These are my boys, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, they say, yeah, we want to, you know, get into the kusheshe and start spinning a kusheshe. Now, I've had 4 Jack Roll attempts.
Sure.
I've had 4 where they were pulling me and putting me in the car, where they came hunting me in my own home. I've been hunted down by the biggest gangsters in Soweto during that time, because of how out I was. So I said this to them, you know, guys, general, I there's no way I can make a video where I'm having you driving around your kusheshe hunting for girls. And so I shared my experience with them. And after sharing this experience, they kind of all agreed, and it didn't occur to them. They were kind of following the trend. The yeah. trend amongst the boys was we're looking for girls, and this was a song that was part of the hunt.
Yeah.
Oh my God, how horrible. Anyway, so I literally was, I said to them, I'm not going to be able to do it. And they were so gracious, you know, like they literally kind of sat back and said, all right, let's think about what else we can do with this video instead.
Mm.
It wasn't successful. I mean, the video itself, you can find it on YouTube. It didn't go far. It didn't go anywhere because I had them being gentlemen in the video.
Really?
I had them being nice to women in this video.
Yeah.
Mandoza brought flowers. General was like opening the door and treating the girl nice. You know, they were nice to women in a song that says we are hunting for women.
Mm.
And I mean, he says, hey, I'm funa wa beba ba moja, right? It's funa wa ntwana. And we have him like, you know, whisking her off and being really nice to her in the process. And that's an anomaly, right?
Yeah.
But I think what that for me said is that my art really is informed by my activism. My lens is very clear about where I stand in issues of human rights abuses. Even in something as fun as a music video, I'm very aware of what we are perpetuating, the stereotypes, the harm that we do with the images and the words that we put out. And I will not be part of that.
Yeah. And so, you know, for you, have you been able to then, I guess, have the film, entertainment, music career that, you know, 10-year-old, 9-year-old you thought about, you then had to delay it ever so slightly in your teens, early 20s, because you were suddenly concerned with this very important work of fighting for your life and the life of other people like you. Have you since been able to then have that career that you, I guess you had to pause it to do this other important work?
What ignites my fire, my flame? Art has always been and will always be at the heart of who I am. So yes, you know, being, I think for the past 25, 30 years, I've been kind of working between reality television as a reality TV director. And I'm talking about the days when reality TV made sense, Goods.
Mm-hmm.
I am sorry. I am one of those people that is going to actually say where we are now is a tragedy.
Yeah. When you say it used to make sense, what do you mean?
I directed shows like All You Need Is Love.
Oh, really? I loved All You Need Is Love.
Remember how good you feel at the end of that show?
Yeah, even if the person gets rejected, right? Because there was always the chance of rejection.
It wasn't emotional.
It was never cruel. Yeah.
It was never cruel because that was the intention. Our intention was we centering love, right? And in the centering of love, we knew that, like, my intention was, if you're watching the whole 48 minutes, I need for you to at least walk away with one big dopamine hit.
Mm.
Either I'm going to make you cry or I'm going to make you laugh, but you're going to get up there feeling good.
Mm.
That was always my intention. So working on All You Need Is Love as a series director, and then going from All You Need Is Love to other types of shows that even the reality competition shows. I worked on 4 seasons of Survivor, for an example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of the people I co-created Forgive and Forget with Bulani Busak. And do you remember the emotion of Forgive and Forget? I think I did 4 seasons of it. And yes, the title was crap. I tried to fight it. I didn't win. The big bosses loved Desmond Tutu, and so it was Forgive and Forget. We forgive, but we never forget. Come on. But the show itself was incredible. I've done Big Brother Africa at a time when we wanted to see how people would get along together from different parts of the continent in those beginnings. That, you know, I feel like I was part of a reality TV movement that had so much love and so much hope and so much beautiful moments. Ah. Now all we're doing is reflecting the worst of ourselves.
Yeah.
So anyway, I've been kind of between reality TV and documentary. And documentary is my forte. I love making documentaries. I've been involved with over 20 documentaries, from Free Mandela Campaign to, you know, my own personal works, some commissioned, some not. My last film was called Lesbians Free Everyone. And that's where I was interacting with all the lesbians from around the world, around the Beijing conference, when we created waves in Beijing and China at the United Nations World Conference on Women.
Yeah.
That was incredible work. I loved every minute. I made that in 2020 during lockdown,
sure.
Literally.
Mm.
And that's what I was doing while everyone else was kind of
making banana bread.
Making banana bread and
pineapple alcohol.
I would have loved, to a degree. I was envious, because at the end of that, lockdown was over and I was exhausted, but now there's no more lockdown.
Those days are gone.
I did the opposite.
Days are
but
gone.
Now I'm working on the film on mom, and it's also it's been a long time coming, because how does nobody know who my mom was?
Yes.
Mom's name is Idlet, and she was a lead singer of the Beaters, which was later called Harari with Hot Sticks and all those guys.
Oh, wow.
She was a front singer of all those bands of the 70s, worked with Brere Piri Chikapa, worked with all these people. See me and they go, hey Bev, Titsy, how's your mom?
Yeah.
How does nobody know her? And so that's the film.
And that's the coming out later this year, you said.
Well, look, we are still in production. We do principal photography towards the end of the year. So it will come out next year.
How exciting.
That is my latest project.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see it. We have received a WhatsApp voice note on 0727021702.
Yo, Cooks, thank you for the interview. Bravo to Beverly. I used to admire her mother. I saw her perform as a young child and changed my name for some time to Idlet.
Hi, Bo.
Well done, Beverly. I salute you.
You were just saying, why don't people know your mom? People do know your mom.
Whoa, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is amazing.
Yeah. So I think
I think mom is listening. Mom is probably tearing up right now.
Very excited about the documentary. Dr. Philemon Mahuna on WhatsApp says, good morning, Gugs and Dr. Titsy. Thank you for your courage and contribution to our country and humanity as a whole. Last year, around this time, you were a guest at the Center for Human Rights at the Universities of Pretoria and Marburg. Best wishes. That's from Dr. Philemon Mahuna in Midstream.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it is the documentary that you are currently working on. Are you still in TV? Yeah. Is there any of your TV work still airing?
No, not currently.
Okay.
Would
you ever do TV again, even though it's in a bit of a weird place?
I love innovation. I love new ideas. I love new innovative things. Right now we are doing exactly the same thing over and over and over and over and over. I don't know why we do that. Okay, so as an example, the Poppy Show. This girl Poppy that is traveling around all over the continent and filming and like doing the craziest things. That should have been on TV a long time ago.
Yeah.
Why is that not on TV?
Yeah.
We are wanting to do the exact same things and be controlling who should be on air. Actually, we need to really relook at what we're doing on our screens. Because really, honestly, a lot of us who've been working in TV right now are not even employed anymore, employable, because we are all questioning the same things, you know?
Yeah.
We are questioning, what are we doing? But also, there isn't, I mean, if you look at where the SABC is, if you're looking at who is right now the only broadcaster, it is really sad, because there's so many TV film practitioners, talented people like me and many, 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 many of us who are right now finding it difficult to work in the space.
Yeah.
If we are even employed, we've become too expensive, we've become too experienced, we question too much. So we are becoming unemployable as well.
Yeah.
So at the moment, the answer is no. And so we keep making our own independent work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I make music. I play with a couple of people once in a while. And I'm making independent film. And that's where we are.
And I'm glad that we still have access to your art. Dr. Titsy, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We are out of time. It's been so great having you on the show. So thank you so much for making time.
Cooks, thank you, thank you, thank you. Enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you for the listeners. Thank you for tuning in and for all the messages. Sending lots of love to everybody.
Thank you very much. That is activist and filmmaker Dr. Beverly Titsy joining us this morning.